Hi, welcome to this Property Life podcast. I'm your host, Mark Winship. I'm a professional property investor, serviced accommodation expert, and property coach. This week, I'm thrilled to welcome Jerry Alexander back to the podcast. I always enjoy my chats with Jerry, and in this episode, we tackle the complex issue of risk management. Risk in property can manifest itself in lots of different ways, and our attitude towards risk can be a big factor in how we choose to invest, what strategy, and to what scale. Jerry is a very experienced investor, and the perspective he brings to this episode is fascinating. Without further ado, let's get going. Morning, Jerry. Welcome back to the podcast. Thanks for joining me. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, Mark. Nice to see you.
Good. Good to see you. And we've got an interesting topic this morning, haven't we? We're talking about risk. And the role that risk plays, I guess, in property investment, and trying to, I guess we're debunking some myths to a certain extent as well around risk, but also hopefully we will send people away with some practical ideas around mitigating some of the risks in.
And I think the danger of risk is that people, risk is potentially danger, right? Wrong choice of word. I think that a lot of people look at it a little bit too simply. It's pretty complex, and there are lots of areas of risk, aren't there, in the property. And for me, originally, I would have just looked at it and said, well, this is just about the development I'm doing and the risk associated with that, right? Yeah. And maybe not finding a tenant. But there's so many other areas, isn't there?
There is. Even to the point of the risk of getting started as a professional property investor, the risk of changing your work situation so that you focus more on property, you know, right down to those sort of lifestyle risks, I guess.
Yeah. A lot of that's opportunity cost though, isn't it? That thing about if I don't do this, what's the consequences of not doing it? Sometimes is the way of actually getting yourself. Some people find that's the only way to motivate themselves.
Yeah.
Fear of missing out.
But it's funny, property, isn't it? Because it's we were talking about this before jumping on the call. It's one of those things that, you know, we've got age old phrases associated with property, which we're all familiar with, like safe as houses. And a lot of people, you know, recognize that actually putting your money into property, into real estate, is in the long term one of the safest investment vehicles. However, you know, we've all probably been at the receiving end of I don't know, loved ones or people around us warning about, oh, do you really want to get into that right now? You know, that sounds like a risky project. Or is this the right time to be investing because of inflation and recession? And, you know, it's on the other side of the coin, it's perceived in some ways to have a lot of risk attached to it. So that's why I thought this would be an interesting conversation to sort of try and debunk that a little bit. Do you find the same thing?
Yeah, there's a lot of contrasting views, and it's quite challenging to actually get to this. We're both learning, right? This whole process. And before this conversation, thinking, well, what exactly is risk and how much is it influenced by the person rather than the situation? And I would think that the person and their approach is fundamental to it, isn't it? Yeah, so you could actually have the same scenario for two different people. You were talking there about loved ones saying, you know, should you be doing this? Is this risky? Well, it might be.
Because
it depends a little bit on that individual and the strategies, the knowledge they have, all the sorts of things, which I guess we'll come on to.
Yeah.
But it's quite interesting that for one person, it could be really risky. For somebody else, it could be mundane and just normal. What's the difference there?
Well, I guess it depends as well. I think personality types comes into it. I hadn't even sort of considered that, but I think you're absolutely right that the same objective criteria, let's say the same investment criteria, might be perceived as high risk by one person, and the exact same criteria would be perceived as lower risk by somebody else, depending on, I guess, their own risk profile, their own appetite towards risk and their own perception of what risk is, I guess, and what the implications are. But I guess it also depends on where you are within your own journey, right? As in a certain property deal might seem risky to me or might have seemed risky to me in the past, whereas it seems less risky now. and vice versa, you know, and it's how you perceive risk changing over the course of time as you bring in experience and everything else that comes along with it.
When you first got started then, did you, looking back now, how did you feel about those first steps in terms of risk? Were you even conscious of it?
I was certainly conscious of it. I think the risk was more getting into the unknown aspects of working with builders, managing a refurb budget, just the stuff that's for most people getting started in property is completely alien territory, and you'll never, unless you're coming from a construction background, you're never going to have brought really any transferable skills into that. So I think that's where we were aware of the risk, was actually sort of going headlong into this. We were fairly confident around demand. So we were looking at HMOs initially. This is where we were initially investing. We were fairly confident with the demand that we'd established. We were pretty confident with our numbers. And therefore, the risk really was project management, I guess, as much as anything.
Yeah, okay. So, I guess we need to be conscious of, while we're having this discussion, about what areas of risk are we talking about? Because there, you mentioned about project risk, and I was asking you what about that first one. But as you grow your portfolio, more risk, new risks come in, such as economic risks, insurance risks.
Yeah,
you know, in terms of actually, what are you insuring here? Is it just the building, or is there other aspects like you as a person? Yeah. Is it the subcontractors? Are you ensuring that subcontractors have proper insurance? All those sorts of things start coming. CDM rules.
Yeah,
there's a lot of risks there that I guess are just pieces of the jigsaw you need to learn as you go in, as you go on.
Yeah.
And with time and help, you should be able to mitigate them. But it amazes me now, even now, well, it doesn't amaze me because I'm talking about myself here, but I still find that every now and then I'm looking at a project or development or something aspect that we're working on, I think, hold on a minute, I haven't fully thought about what happens if that happens.
Yeah.
What happens if that happens, and are we covered for that? And sometimes it's not to paying a physical insurance sum, but it's an activity or something you have to do to try and mitigate that. It's quite. I think the industry is quite forgiving. You know, you take time to do things, but there are some key risks, I guess, you need to cover in terms of insuring yourself, covering certain things with contractors and projects. What sort of things do you think would fit in with that, Mark?
Well, I'm just thinking actually while you're talking about what risks for me are sort of a constant, if that makes sense. What risks am I aware of still at this stage in our property journey, in the same way that I probably was at the beginning? And I'd imagine I share some common ground with most people investing. The risk of being potentially not over leveraged, because that is actually one of the steps that we can take to mitigate against the risk of things like negative equity. But leverage is the degree of leverage you have in terms of lending is a risk, and the long term plan and the steps, putting steps in place to deleverage to a certain extent, because that helps reduce perceived risk, I think. And the other one is the risk of having all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah.
So, like, reflecting on our own situation right now, we're very, very all in on hospitality and serviced accommodation. And I, as I've said multiple times on the podcast, I am not in any way fearful of regulation that is likely to come into the industry. In fact, I would welcome it. That's not an issue. Having said that, there's some kind of grounded logic in diversifying your portfolio, potentially having a slight mix of strategies, and just the feeling that mitigates against the risk of, you know, running yourself into a dead end effectively.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of what's, you know, yeah, it's prevalent for us all the time is that feeling in the background, I think.
And there's another risk here that actually probably has the biggest impact, or at least through their mind, through people's thinking about it, is the risk of failure.
Yes.
That's maybe not one you can insure against.
Yes.
But it's one that you probably have to do the most work on, is that feeling of risk of failure, proving the other, the naysayers right, and the challengers that are maybe saying that you don't know what you're doing. What do you think people that you've seen that come through PWS and you've worked with, the ones that have really gone on and made things happen, what do you see different? Is it their perception of risk? Is it something to do with their perception of risk of failure, or they don't have a risk? What's your thoughts about people that have come through, been very successful? What's their attitude to being risk, to being to risk? Has it been just cavalier, or actually they've just got a different approach to it?
Yeah, that's the key question, isn't it? And I think it comes down to being really clear about defining what we're talking about here when we talk about risk. And I think some people, when they're talking about risk, are actually talking about being reckless or speculating, which is not what we're in the game of at all. In fact, risk management is the game, you know, to a certain extent. And this is not about sticking your head in the sand or being cavalier, like you say, and ignoring the risks. That would be reckless. It's actually, you know, being very confronting the risks and doing a really in-depth analysis of the risks in a way. So really, you know, tackling them head on, because only by doing that can we then take proactive and practical steps to mitigate those risks. So I don't, you know, risk has a negative label attached to it. But from my perspective, people ask me all the time, well, you know, or they might say to me, so people that we've got friends or we've got family, you know, who don't invest in property, and then look at what we're doing. I could never do what you're doing. I'm far too risk averse to do what you're doing. And I find that really interesting, because it's not, you know, their implication there is that somehow I'm wired differently, and that I don't care about the risks in the same way that they do. And I don't think that that's the case. I think it's just partly through education, partly through experience, partly through surrounding yourself with other people that you can learn from who've done a similar thing, we're able to confront those risks.
If you love to travel like me and you understand the power in escaping the money for time exchange trap, but you just don't know how to do it, then building an Airbnb consultancy business could be exactly what you have been looking for. Right now in the UK, there is a completely untapped opportunity through helping struggling Airbnb hosts by turning around their underperforming properties and generating you huge commission payments in the process. We are going to teach you all of the tools and all of the techniques that we've learned over the last 5 years through building our very own multiple six-figure Airbnb business, arming you with everything that you need to swoop in and save the day. Minimal startup costs, zero risk, and almost unlimited potential. Sound good? Welcome to the Airbnb Consultant. Contact us through any of the channels included in the studio notes to get the conversation started.
And put steps in place to mitigate against them. So you almost have a, what's it called? Like a, not a fallback plan, but you know, we, you go, right, if that eventuality happens, then this is my mitigating step. If that happened, I would do this. You know, if the industry went in this direction, then we'd go in this direction. You know, and you almost have a, what's it called? It's like a fail-safe plan. Like there's, it'll come to
plan A, B, C, D, E.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that's for me is the difference is the perception of risk and the embracing risk as part of the process and not be, it's like that famous quote around bravery, isn't it? Bravery is not the absence of fear. It's what you do in response to fear.
Feeling the fear and doing it anyway. Yeah, yeah,
exactly. And I think that, you know, risk management is not about ignoring risks. If anything, it's about really recognizing and analyzing the risks and then taking steps.
So I think a good thing we should maybe do, maybe not right now, but is between us, just run through a list of what we've come across that we felt these are risks we need to mitigate, just to give people a bit of context around what we're talking about. Yeah, but just to go back to what you're saying there, it doesn't sound like you consider yourself risky, your attitude.
I wouldn't consider myself to be risky. No, because I don't consider our model and our approach to be risky. If that makes sense.
So million pound developments with no fixed income, right? Trading businesses, not risky at all.
Well, no, I would acknowledge that the risks exist. This is the difference, isn't it? I would acknowledge that the risk exists, but I don't feel that what we're doing is risky because, and I guess this is where your due diligence comes in, you know, and you'll be the same. I know you're the same from a commercial perspective in terms of due diligence of, you know, what does the market require? What need is there for particular offerings? And, you know, really looking at very early on in the process so that you know by the time you bring this product to the market that you've already qualified a demand for it, you know, because, you know, obviously spending time with yourself and you're talking a lot about speaking to other people that operate in the area and to potential licensees or tenants before the building's even complete. So it's not this is risky. I really hope people are going to like this when I've done it. I think it's great, but you're actually almost like, you know, generating and qualifying that demand at the same time as you go through. Would that be right to say?
Yeah, that would be right. And we don't generally go a huge geograph. We don't, at the moment, our network of buildings are pretty close together. So there's always a little bit of overlap, almost a cross-selling between buildings. Some of them, the furthest I think they're apart is about an hour from the sort of one extreme to the other. And we do have tenants or clients that use, you know, buildings on both extremes. So if we went somewhere completely new, then I know I am increasing my risk because my understanding of that market is not as strong as currently, you know, in our area that we're in. But that's getting on to mitigation, isn't it? And ways you can do that. Should we just talk about maybe some of the risks we think about? You just mentioned one there. A risk is not knowing what market demand is.
Yeah, definitely.
Another one would be, as you said, having plan A, B, C, D, and E. It's you know, if this thing doesn't work, what's my backup here? So that risk of it not working.
Particularly if you're dealing in developments where, because we always talk about having a second exit, right? You know, at least one additional exit. So if you are doing a buy to let, you know, will the property, if for whatever reason the rental market shifts, will the property sell and still make a profit or still at least cover your costs, and vice versa. If you're looking to flip a property, but the market takes a downturn and it's not conducive to flipping, can you rent that property out and it will still wash its face? When, I don't know what you find, but we are starting to go towards developments where we're altering the building to such an extent that it would be very difficult to revert that to any other use than its current use. So, you know, I'm thinking about the hotel development that we've recently launched down on the South Coast. It would be very difficult without significant additional expenditure to revert that, for example, to resi. Yes. Room sizes and everything else. So there is an element, and there certainly was an element of risk in terms of, and again, this is where it's hard to separate personality versus the actual the actual genuine kind of fact and hard risk. So, you know, we had done all of our usual due diligence around market analysis of short stay patterns and trends in that area. So we had all the evidence pointing towards the fact that this would be successful. But I guess it's the number of zeros involved in the project that makes you a little bit nervous around, okay, we've opened the doors. Is it going to book? Are people going to like it? Are we going to get good reviews and therefore develop some momentum? Are we going to be able to generate some corporate relationships where we can get some corporate bookings in, et cetera, et cetera? So, and because although a lot would have to go wrong in a sense to end up in the worst case scenario, but you do end up thinking, well, in this case, we don't have a fallback necessarily of a second exit other than to flip it on.
So this is really interesting. We're both in the space business, right? And we're both in service space. You're the only difference is you're
by the night.
People stay overnight, or tend to stay during the day, right? But what you're talking about there is when you take a project or an investment and you turn it more into an operating business, or there's an operating element, which by definition means that there should be higher margin.
Yes.
That's the point of doing it. So so now we're starting to talk a little bit about risk and reward.
Yeah.
So you may be investing more or being a bit more niche. Yeah. So what you've done is you've kind of leveraged the risk a little bit here and just saying, right, I'm gonna knuckle down to a more specific niche because I have learned, understand that that can provide me with a higher return.
Yeah,
but you know there is a risk, slightly higher risk, as you've just pointed out. That okay, I'm a bit more niche here, but there's much higher reward, which does mean that your payback period should be much quicker.
Yes,
so that there's it's having that conversation in your mind all the time about risk reward, and you know if somebody says I've got an investment here that's going to give you 25-30% return on total money in, not capital employed, whatever, but the total money in, a lot of people would say, well, that's going to be a high risk strategy. And it probably is.
Yeah.
But it's probably quite niche.
Yes.
So you need to know what you're doing, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So what's your thoughts on the risk reward side?
Yeah, because you will hear that quoted pretty consistently. I'm sure you're the same. I'm a sucker for reading biographies of entrepreneurs and business people, and that comes up a lot, isn't it, that you can track back to a certain degree their success to a point at which they took a risk, as it were. The level of investment, and it's really interesting you use the term leveraging the risk, because I think that's exactly the process. And that would only be potentially advisable or relevant, I think, at different stages in your journey. But at the stage we're at, with the knowledge base we've acquired from operating in that space for a number of years, we felt comfortable that we could leverage the risk. And the risk versus reward dictates that the returns on taking that risk are significantly higher. And that's really what is sort of driving the project. And then I guess it's the experience that we have developed over the years that we've been doing this, to know how we respond to a downturn in the market. What would we do? I mean, we operate service accommodation through COVID. I mean, any operators that have survived service accommodation through COVID should wear some sort of special, there should be an accreditation, I think, some sort of badge that you wear. Because anyone who survived Airbnb and Booking.com closing your calendar for months on end, that you learned certain skills.
Yeah.
And you had to really graft and hustle. And I guess that coming out of that gives you a certain degree of confidence that it's like making your peace with the worst case scenario, isn't it?
Yeah.
If this happened, what would we do? We'd do this. And if this happened, it'll be fine because we'll just do this.
Yeah.
And having that bank of experience to fall back on. That's why I think it's your perception of the risk changes depending on where you are in your journey. Had we done that much earlier without any real experience of where do I find corporate bookings or direct contractor bookings or whatever, how do we do that? Then I think the perceived risk would have been.
It's interesting. And you're talking there about confidence, and confidence can lead to higher risk.
Yeah.
If you've got overconfidence, you may start getting to that other risk, which is being blindsided by not being consciously trying to be open to look at other. This is not to be paralyzed by analysis or to just not do anything, but equally just being open to the mind of the fact that what if that happened, what if this happened, and being I guess not overconfident in your skill set, and there's always that risk.
That
we have this conversation and in 2 or 3 months' time, something unravels because you got blindsided.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of choppy things going on in the market right now, aren't there, that we need to think about in going back to that list. So one being finance, of course, and the risk of interest rates going up. The other one, which is being is very overt right now, is about energy costs, which you and I both take control of. It's not necessarily our clients that do that. And there's also the risk of things happening, not just economically, but equally internally in the company, whether it's to you, whether it's one of your key employees, whether it's one of your key suppliers, all these different things that you kind of need that extra layer of support should one of those things happen. Mm. The challenge, of course, is if you're trying to get started in this, thinking about all that means you never get started, right?
Well, this is it. So you mentioned just now, which is a really interesting point, you mentioned about paralysis by analysis. And I realize I'm slightly going to contradict some of the things that I've just said by saying, but at some point we all have to take a leap. And I know that to some people sounds reckless, or that, and that's not what it is. But you know, you can go round and round in circles. You're never going to remove all of these aspects of elements of risk 100%. So there comes a point. Let's say you're just starting out. There comes a point where you're just going to have to do it. You know, you can do all the due diligence in the world, but until you actually put that product out into the market, you by definition won't truly know if there's a demand for it. Like, you know, we mitigate the risk, but there's always going to be an element of, at some point you've got to go, do you know what? I've done enough due diligence now to warrant the risk, if that makes sense.
You have to step over the line.
Yes, exactly. You have to what's your phrase? Get in the swim.
Well, getting in the swim is just going out and learning what's going on and finding out what's happening in your market and really understanding your local market. But going back to what you're saying there about getting all your ducks lined up, at some point you are going to have to step over the line. And that's when I think there's that taste of the risk then, right there, because that's the point where you actually have to make the decision. But all of that background work is to mitigate risk. While we're having this conversation, it's reminding me of, I'm pretty sure it's Robert Kiyosaki, who talks a lot about reducing his risk by absolutely knowing his market and what he does. Yeah. So if you're in service accommodation and the size of projects you're looking at, if you absolutely know your market, both the client, the property type, and the location, then you should be mitigating your risk. And there's that whole juxtaposition where people say, oh, you need to diversify. You need to diversify. And it depends on who you are and what you're doing. If you're in the stock market and you have no clue on how to manage the stock market, then, yeah, sure, you probably need to mitigate risk by doing the whole thing about let's invest over years and let's make sure we have a diversified portfolio.
Yeah.
But the risk reward thing is, if you really know a company that is doing something very special and you really understand their management team and what the changes in legislation or regulation or whatever it is that's going to happen that is going to propel that company forward, then there's still a risk that some of those things won't happen, but you're in much clearer picture of what's going on. So I think it's just the same for us in property, is that, you know, starting out with a diversified portfolio to me sounds pretty risky, because if you're just getting started, how are you going to know with enough detail about all those different markets and those different entry points into property? So actually, that is not going to work in reducing your risk. You actually need to concentrate on one activity, one strategy, and just get to know it really well.
And potentially,
that way you're mitigating it.
Potentially one area.
Yes.
You know, in terms of really understanding, I know when we first started out investing in HMOs, I mean, we shortlisted a number of areas and really started to focus on one in particular, which was Liverpool at the time. And in many ways, that's driven by necessity, in that my desire to understand that market in that area to the level of detail that I knew would be required to feel I'd mitigated those risks to get into that market meant that any spare time we had to dedicate to this, we would have to be in that area, in the streets, speaking to the agents, building relationships, the idea of a scattergun approach where I just randomly plucking rundown properties off Rightmove all over the country, that's risk, like you say, because I don't know anything about the market where those properties exist. You know,
but that whole picture there completely points out the shades of grey of this. So there we are saying, if you're getting started, get really focused, get really good knowledge on a specific strategy in a specific area. But then when you start building that portfolio, one of the risks starts appearing is being in one area and one specific strategy and everything else is actually a risk, right? That's the the oddity of it. And that's when it's like, okay, right, now I need to start maybe diversifying my strategy types and my areas, because the macroeconomics is fine, but actually we all invest locally. So the macroeconomics have a background noise, but actually we really must concentrate on our local area to actually understand what's going on. But ultimately, yeah, we have to avail ourselves of lots of different strategies and start working into different areas to then start reducing that risk. It is a bit of an oddity, isn't it? So it does depend on where you're at in your journey.
And I say this to a lot, well, I've said it a lot on the podcast. I say it a lot to students and coaching clients, is I believe that one of the things that differentiates a professional property investor from somebody who, just wants to amateur armchair investment, just wants to park some cash and hopefully realize a yield from it. What defines us as professional property investors is our ability to deploy whatever strategy best fits the current market conditions in the area we're looking at. And so I guess I draw confidence from knowing that actually if there was a shift in whatever that might be, I would have A, enough knowledge to at least get started, and B, a community of people that I can tap into that have a lot more knowledge than I do to be able to then roll out a strategy that does work.
Yep.
You know, and actually for a period of time, if the economic climate or market conditions dictate, I might switch to a slightly different strategy because that is what is optimal for that situation. And you talk about macro and micro. I come from a sports background and sports coaching background and working with top athletes. And a conversation that we would have almost on a daily basis would be around control the controllables, which is twofold, which is understanding in terms of mitigating risk. Have you done everything in your power within the things that are in? Have you prepared thoroughly enough? Have you trained well? Have you analyzed your opponent? Have you prepared your body? Have you eaten correctly? Have you done everything within your power going into that event, whilst also acknowledging that during that event, there will be any number of things completely outside of your control that you then have to draw upon your adaptability, your problem-solving skills, etc., to respond to. And it's that's no different, right, to property. Yeah. It's exactly the same. I get to the point we talked about, getting to a point where you're ready to make a leap. I've done everything within my control, reasonably within my control, to analyze, do due diligence, etc. I appreciate that there will always be elements out of my control, but these are the steps I've taken to do everything I can to mitigate against that, I guess.
Yeah. So talking about mitigation, I mean, the fundamental thing here is mitigation of risk is through knowledge and experience.
Yes.
And you're either going to have to go out there and learn that yourself, or you try and lean on others that have been there before to try and get those lessons early to mitigate that risk for yourself.
Yeah. Knowledge and experience, not necessarily your own.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
but I think that's a really key take home message though, isn't it? And I'm spending time with yourself, really enjoying learning about your commercial project and in many ways tapping into your knowledge base and experience. And, you know, I've always had that mindset. If we're going to do something, we're going to do it properly. We're going to learn from the best. And I think that this isn't a case of analyze your market, do a bit of due diligence and that's a one hit, one time thing. We're always evolving. We're always keeping up to speed with market trends. You know, we're always paying attention to what's going on within our industry, always learning, always getting mentoring. So in a way, that's mitigating risk, right? Because you you're constantly sort of staying ahead of the curve, I guess.
Yeah. And the point of this podcast is not to paralyze you.
No.
You know, it's just to be conscious it's an ever-evolving thing, and that you're in control. It is your decision making that ultimately will lead you down the right or the wrong path. But you need to get some just context around what you're doing, and as we say, really focus in on a strategy and an area that's going to allow you to get enough knowledge to mitigate that risk. It's been something that has evolved for me, and over time I do sometimes look back and I think, was that a big risk or not? And then of course in hindsight you look at it and think, well, actually no, it wasn't. But there are one or two things I've looked at and I thought, do you know what, especially in terms of as our projects get bigger, there's definitely project risks, and I want to just cover this a little bit in that list. What the project risks that I've not really paid attention to as much as I should have in the earlier days were things like insurance to subcontractors, method statements, risks assessments,
CDM.
RAMs, I think they're called. Yeah, CDM.
Yeah.
These sorts of things that you just think, oh man, that sounds like a whole can of worms. I think I'll ignore that just now.
And unfortunately, most people don't take it seriously until something goes wrong.
That's exactly right. And you know, the result of that can be pretty scary.
Yeah.
You know, so you do need to try and cover yourself for these things. But there are lots of experts and professionals out there, and I don't think anyone would ever try and start doing that themselves. They would use an expert or professional until they get to a point where they're comfortable in doing that. And it's even when you're doing a refurb, actually, all these things are still part of the equation.
Yeah.
But, you know, you could argue, well, maybe the risk is a little bit less.
Yeah.
Than a very large project. And I can't remember what the number is. There's a certain number where I think it might be £500,000 that you have to actually tell the, what are they called? I won't say HMRC, it's not HMRC, the other guys, HSE, that you're embarking on a particular project. There's a certain value that they need to be informed about. And these things I just didn't know about when I got started. But working with architects and asking them, right, what do I need to know about method statements, risk assessments? Are you guys taking on the CDM responsibilities? It's just knowing some of those questions. You don't need to know the answers and how to do it all. It's just I guess I'm just trying to say, here's a little list of things you might want to just think about. And then, of course, there's insuring the work itself, insuring the property, because it, you know, not just getting insurance that has that specific property listed without perhaps building works going on. There's a difference there between when it's fully occupied, when it's unoccupied, when is building works going on. And you kind of need to let people know, because I think one of the risks that people don't think about is underinsuring. I'm not saying go out and cover yourself in all sorts of bubble wrap, but these are things that if they do go wrong, they can be quite expensive.
Yeah.
And sometimes life-changing.
Yeah. And these aren't the sexy things about property, are they?
No, they're not. as you get more and more professional, or not professional. I mean, let's face it, if you're doing this, you really need to up your game on these sorts of things, because at some point something might go wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to go back, almost taking us full circle, just to sort of square things off a little bit.
Yeah.
Full circle, square things off. I don't know if that works. Yeah. To what we alluded to it right at the beginning, which is actually the risk of getting started. So you talk about opportunity versus reward, and let's just look at it from this perspective. Do you think, I feel there's a tendency that some people in their excitement and enthusiasm to make changes to their lives, and they think, you know, they believe, and we've got enough evidence to suggest that they're right to believe that property could be the solution to that, but they leave the day job too early in that process. What would your advice to be to someone who was saying, look, you know, I just want to pack in my job, I want to go full-time as a property investor?
You You know, we can't just generalize on that, can we? It's no. So much down to the individual. Some people work really well with their back up against the wall.
Yeah.
But you need to understand yourself fully before you do that on a whim.
Yeah.
I was really fortunate when I left work. My wife and I were both earning a wage, not particularly big wage. I was younger, obviously, but quite a bit younger. And we could survive on the one wage. But what we did after reading Richest Man in Babylon and all those sorts of things, we saved up some money. I started a business, took a small income, and that's really how we got going. Our property journey started about 9 months into that. So we started a different business to get myself out of work and then, or to give myself a bit more free time. And then we focused in on the property. So I had kind of a little bit of a plan there. And the intention then was to get my wife out of work, which took a bit of time, but we got to that stage as well, which was brilliant. But I think just on a whim is not the right thing. And there are some people that just need to have that security blanket. And what I think we're really, really fortunate with in property is it's a bit like a Meccano set. You can just add another layer, another house, another commercial property, whatever it is, and you're just adding income streams. I think I'm sure it's not unique, but we're just really lucky in that you can do that. And you can picture, right, I need £3,000 a month to be able to get out of work, or whatever the number is. How many houses is that? Or how many HMOs or whatever? It's really, we're very lucky on that front. But for some people, yeah, it might be that they do need to put their back up against the wall, but I think they probably need a little bit of money behind them.
Yeah.
Or certainly some of that risk reduction, i.e. they've gained a lot of knowledge, they've maybe got some traction going on, there's some projects coming up that they have got in the pipeline that are going to make that difference. Mm. But what I also... It's a bit like taking on employees. Sometimes the risk is actually much smaller than you think. So if you're taking on an employee, and let's say they're an expensive employee, they're £3,000, £5,000 a month, whatever it is, maybe a bit more. At the end of the day, if it doesn't work, you can have a conversation and end that, right? Because it's not working. And it's kind of the same with leaving a job. At the end of the day, you've got a good income, right? You leave a job, if it doesn't work, it's not like there's going to be a hole there forever. You can go and get another job. And yeah. I'm maybe being a little bit flippant there, and especially if you've got a very specialist job. But it's not, it is crossing a line, but it's not do or die. Yeah. You can change if a strategy doesn't work. Yeah. So there's back to that risk-reward thing. Have you got a few plan A, Bs and Cs? Is there a little bit of backing in the background? Pick a period of time you're going to do this for, but be aware, a bit like an auction, where your ceiling is. I'm going to do this for 6 months. I'm going to do this for 9 months, whatever it is. And if it doesn't quite work to plan, make sure you're not got your head in the sand and you can take some corrective action.
And you're right to point out that there is a strong element of knowing yourself in all of this.
Yeah.
Because I look back and think that, in terms of all the objective measures of finance and the financial pressure it created for us to really make things work, I probably left my job a year early, according to those measures. However, I do know that I work extremely well with my back to the wall, and the urgency and the pain that creates and how that drives and creates a motivation. I do know historically that I respond well to that, and it's also knowing the space I was in mentally, emotionally, everything in that job and where that would have taken me. So actually needing to change my mindset and refresh things a little bit was arguably,
there was a risk there.
Stacking up. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It was stacking up, just as much against the risk of the financial risk of stopping, I guess.
Yeah.
And so it is about knowing yourself, and again, we were in a similar situation to yourself by the sounds of it. So my wife is still in employment actually, and so I guess we always had the sort of the absolute backstop of her salary. It's not like we suddenly left ourselves with no income coming into the household whatsoever. But yeah, it created an urgency for us to take some serious action and build some momentum and replace my salary as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And arguably sometimes where you see investors and students making slow progress, it might be because they don't have that pain. They don't have that. Things are just a little bit too comfortable. And therefore, what is it that is going to drive you through the tough times and the ups and downs to really see it through and push it through if you don't have that sort of that push-pull situation?
Yeah, we this conversation can go on for a very long time because there's so many avenues, isn't there? And it does absolutely 100% come down to you knowing yourself.
Yeah.
So that you it's particularly in that scenario of what can I and can't I do? And how do I operate? How does my brain operate? It's funny, I find myself trying to work out tricks to get over myself and to get around myself, because the biggest holder back, the thing that holds me back the most, right, is me. So yeah. You're constantly trying to work out, how do I work around that one? And sort of when you've got a moment of silence, it's just thinking, right, I keep coming stuck there. How am I going to get myself motivated to get around that? What steps can I put in place to avoid that bit where I pause or I stop? Not to just go gung-ho, but just to make sure that I'm being more productive.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting.
It's very interesting. I think we've stumbled across a series of content here.
Yeah.
It's almost a separate podcast, a risky business podcast. Sure.
I think
that has been a really interesting conversation. Like I said, I think it's probably the launch pad down various routes we could take it, but hopefully people have found that interesting and useful to listen to. So as always, Jerry, thank you so much for your input this morning. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Mark. It's been great. I love doing these sorts of things because it makes you think about yourself and about how you are doing your day-to-day stuff. So it's part of my learning process too. So thanks for having me on, Mark.
Yeah, I do say that actually. The podcast is just one big therapy couch for me.
Yeah.
But no, brilliant. Thank you so much for that. And I will catch up with you soon.
Yeah, will do. Cheers.
Cheers, Jerry. Take care.
Thanks for listening. I really hope you enjoyed that episode. It was a fun one to record and has certainly got me thinking about lots of new content for future episodes. Speaking of which, it would be great to know what content you would like to hear on the podcast. The best way is to connect with us over on the Property Wealth System community page on Facebook and tell us about what you would like to hear. It would be great to hear that you are listening to the podcast and to understand how I can have value moving forwards. Please like and follow or subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcast fix. That just makes it easier for other people to discover the podcast too. And if you get a minute to leave us a review, that would be hugely appreciated. Thanks again for listening, and I will catch you on the next episode.